What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, John Krofcik and Larry Rifkin. And John, I think most of those who are listening to us will have a vague recollection of a standoff. The name Bundy might come to mind and symbolize resistance to the U.S. government.
Well, I don't quite understand this whole thing, even when it was going on, because the federal government had leased them the land to use, I guess, and then they pulled it away. I don't really know how at all. But there was I do remember there was a big standoff.
Well, we'll get into the weeds, or more like the desert. We'll get into the preserve. We'll get into all of that. But I think some of the issues surrounding Ammon Bundy and the various people who lined up on one side or the other, and there was a fatality in all of this, that these issues regarding private interests and public lands, while murky, are really important, and they do symbolize some of the divides that we have in our country right now.
Wow. I don't know about that, but I know it sure affected those ranchers. I don't know how it really divides in our country.
But in many ways, John, the squabble going on in eastern Oregon was a proxy battle for the divided politics that we see throughout the country today. Some insist that the federal government has no right to own these public lands, while others might see Mr. Bundy and the occupiers as dangerous extremists, cowboys, living in an era gone by. But one does use the Constitution and use various clauses of the Constitution in very interesting ways to suggest that he's right. And, of course, the government feeling that, well, when you think about it, what does the government own in America today? About one-third of the land.
Right.
So there's a lot of land that the federal government owns to preserve and protect for various public uses that stands, I guess, some kind of test over time in many courts about their ability to take that land.
Well, this is the part I didn't understand, because we're talking about basically, I think, grazing rights, because you have these herds that these private interests have.
And right, they lease them out.
Right. So, I'm still kind of confused on with the government and with them. I don't really understand, because they do lease it out. They do let them use it. It's kind of a foggy area for me.
Yeah, well, you didn't have the benefit of this interview with Anthony McCann, and that's why I think it's going to be great to listen today. He wrote the book Shadowlands, A Western Tale of America in Crisis, Fear and Freedom at the Oregon Standoff. And he tries to unravel what is a rather complicated picture and dispute and put it into the context of the fractured United States
today. All right,
today.
Well, I'm anxious to hear this.
And I'll tell you, it'd be very interesting to hear from any of our listeners after, when you engage with us on social media, on Facebook or Twitter, has your position drifted once you hear the story and understand it better? Again, we still have glimpses into this story because it was on the front pages. It was on the news every night.
I remember it, yeah.
But even the reports were rather complicated. But I think we'll try to break it down for you, lay down the issues that were in play. And I think you're going to be very surprised, John, because who knew that involved in this were Native American tribal leaders, public lands ranchers, militia members, environmentalists, even Black Lives Matter got tangled up in this.
Wow.
And that's part of the story that I don't think we've heard before.
No, it was the ranchers against the government.
Yeah, I know, but it's much more textured and nuanced, as most stories are. So where better than the Wild West to have these disputes about the meaning of the Constitution and American soil? It will get you thinking. He's the author, again, Anthony McCann. Shadowlands is the book, today on America Trends.
On the line with us on America Trends is Anthony McCann. He's written the book Shadowlands, Fear and Freedom at the Oregon Standoff, and it's an account of the 2016 occupation of what has become known as the Bad Luck National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. And it's a fascinating account, and I think if you don't remember anything else about it, you probably remember the last name Bundy. So, Anthony, when you start a conversation with somebody about, number one, how you got involved in writing the story, because you've done a lot of fiction, and why this really was so fascinating to you, what do you say to them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm actually not a fiction writer. I'm a poet. And all my books prior to now were poetry books, which I think surprises people even more. Mm-hmm. But I was writing a very different kind of book, a prose book, or I thought I was, because it didn't happen. This happened instead. A kind of more lyrical, essayistic book about the desert, where I live in the Mojave Desert. This incident happened at the far northern reaches of the Great Basin Desert. And I was writing largely about sort of the experience of time and of history in the desert, which is very different from the experience of those things in other places. And I had become very interested in specifically, in late 2015, Native American messianic religious practices over the history of the continent after white settlement. And there are many of these religions basically spanning the continent from east to west, as the line of settlement went west and the time of crisis came for different tribal groups. Different religions emerged that allowed for more pan-tribal unity and different religious practices that were more helpful in those times. They were often apocalyptic and messianic, often with the earth itself in the role of a redeemer, like that would come and overturn and push back invading Europeans and establish a new realm where the living and the dead would be together and things like this. The most famous of these is the Ghost Dance. That's the one that most people have heard of. It's the last one, really, the last great Native American messianic religion. And that came out of the Great Basin Desert from a northern Paiute prophet named Wovoka. So I was reading about all this stuff. And then suddenly on January 2nd, 2016, a man named Ammon Bundy, a very devout Latter-day Saint anti-federal lands activist, with a group of internet friends, basically, took over the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Malheur means bad luck in French, though many people involved in the occupation didn't seem to notice this, or it didn't fit into their plans anyway. Took over that refuge to protest a number of things, a case that was happening in that county, Harney County, Oregon, involving a father and son rancher. But also, very quickly, it was clear that Ammon Bundy's sites were on bigger things, including the turning over of all the federal land of the West to local authorities or state authorities or private persons. And the rhetoric coming from Ammon was incredibly messianic as well, though of a very, very different kind than this historical Native American messianism that I had been interested in. And the fact that this is all happening in this intense landscape just drew me in, and very quickly I was up there. I got in touch with the local Paiute tribe who had emerged as leaders in the opposition to the occupation, and to go up and talk to them about their history in relation to this stuff. And then that turned into years of following the court cases, talking to the occupiers, and following different historical leads and connections along the lines of their ideas and actions and the ideas and actions of persons opposed to them or in their peripheries.
So you found yourself in the middle of this maelstrom. You found it fascinating. I think it's fair to say that you have some fondness toward Ammon Bundy. And you brought yourself to the question through all of this, in what sense does a nation have being anyway? Because when you look at these gentlemen, they consider themselves sovereign citizens or a patriot movement. And the father said that he doesn't recognize the United States government as even existing. So how surprising were these ideas as you came upon them?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say I have a fondness for Ammon, but I have a fascination for Ammon. He's a very fascinating, okay. He's a very fascinating character. And he's very likable. He's a very likable, very recognizable Latter-day Saint way, very personable. But those, I mean, the ideas as they were coming out, some of them were familiar and some of them were new, just living in the West and familiar with strong anti-federal sentiment. But the particular theological bent of them was largely new to me, or what I did know of it I knew from 2014 from the standoff at the Bundy Family Ranch, which is in Nevada, much closer to where I live, in the same county as Las Vegas. And that's when more of the world learned about these ideas that have a certain currency in the far right on the left about the federal government not really being allowed to own land. Cliven Bundy, Ammon Bundy's father, and the Bundy family, and a lot of people in their Latter-day Saint and rancher milieu in the West have been holding for some time that there's a clause in the Constitution which says that the United States cannot own or manage public land or land at all beyond certain very limited cases. Most people, including the courts and legal scholars and constitutional scholars, understand that particular clause as pertaining to the District of Columbia and other things and not really having anything to do with what they're talking about. But they've held on to that with a sort of religious certainty. They believe the Constitution is divinely inspired. And they were coming to this other place, Ammon and his brother, and his father wasn't involved in this, but Ammon and his brother and a lot of the people who had been involved in a standoff in 2014 at the Bundy Ranch in Nevada to kind of push their message forward, which is both a political message and a theological message.
And I understand your point, Anthony, but just to the question, in what sense does a nation have being anyway, which is something that you were brought to in the course of looking at these events, what did you come to in your own mind?
Well, to go back to what Ammon, to the Bundy approach, it's very much a political theology that they're bringing to bear, and what success they've had in gathering followers is very much based on the religious appeal of that theology and the sort of field of being that generates, you know, with that understanding of the Constitution that they have, and that understanding and fetishization of the enclave clause, an understanding that others don't agree with, part of an understanding of the Constitution as a divinely inspired document, right, that establishes both a territory and a time that has a unique place in human history, right, and so therefore, you know, their movement has a tremendous amount of appeal to the people who come to it because it promises a role in not just the putting the United States back on track on its supposedly, according to Ammon and Cliven and the Bundy family, divine path, but also all of humanity itself. So that's one understanding of a nation as this like theologically blessed geography, right, and also temporality, right, gathering all of humankind in Mormon thought. It's, you know, this is the what Joseph Smith called the dispensation of the fullness of times, where all the different dispensations of the world are being gathered into one towards the culmination of human time. And, you know, unite in Latter-day Saint thinking, the place where this is happening is here, right, in the new world. So that's one very specific understanding of a nation and a place. But I think that in, you know, secular understandings of nations get very strange for us because there's certain sort of assumptions what we make about what the territory of a nation is and what it means to live in a nation. But those are actually very abstract, right? All you have to do is like dissolve the government and the thing doesn't exist anymore, especially in a country like the United States, which is so complicated in terms of its history and so troubled in its history and made up of so many different persons and cultures. In a lot of ways, you know, a nation is a place where you have a bunch of abstractions and ideas grounded in centuries of practice and also of violence. And then you have boundaries, which are abstractions, but which are enforced by real bodies and real lethality, and the back and forth interplay of that, of the way the abstraction of a nation is made real, is something that I found fascinating in this story, and I find fascinating in general. And it's something that becomes more apparent to me in the desert, not just because of this story, but I live a pretty remote place, but I live also near a huge Marine base. So sometimes, you know, the Marines are busy, and it reminds me of the actual very material reality of the United States of America. Other times it's easy to forget that our contemporary world exists at all.
Well, the enclave clause perhaps is symbolic of the fact that we can have so many different interpretations of the Constitution, or misinterpretations of the Constitution. And, of course, he was saying that, one of the Bundys, that it wasn't his land, it's we the people. and it wasn't the government's land. So he's got this whole other view, and who are we the people in this construct?
Well, that, I mean, that's something that was fascinating in this story, and it's always true. I mean, everybody who's mobilizing political sentiment, whether they think of themselves as right, left, or center, or none of the above, right, is intending to speak for we the people, while also creating like a field of being and feeling that attracts people to join themselves to that body of we the people, and hoping to gain enough momentum to, you know, gain credibility. And there were certainly many different we the peoples swirling around in this story, in the center of it and at the peripheries. And it was a conflict of different we the peoples and their different geographies, their different understandings of the Constitution, their different understandings of the earth. And I mean, I think that's just something that's a fact about democracy.
Well, when
particularly
you see
intense
all
right now,
the instability, you know, in America today and the polarization and divides, I mean, when you see a dispute like this and so many different interests coming into play, including the Native Americans. I mean, what do you say about the way America hangs together in this abstraction of the Constitution and the sense that we don't hang together by an ethnicity, but by ideas?
Well, clearly it becomes very fraught when you have times of great impasse, right? Because then you just have people appealing to abstractions, which they attempt to make real through feeling, right? Mm-hmm. And through practice, but which remain abstractions. I mean, whether they're the ones that Ammon Bundy believes or the ones that, you know, I hold more feeling for, they're still abstractions. Whether it's the idea of public land, that, which is one that would be more important for me, that like it belongs to all of us, that it's our most precious inheritance, that it's, you know, you hear this kind of thing from people from my perspective, that would be, it belongs as much to a man sleeping on a bench in New York City as it belongs to a rancher in Nevada, as it belongs to whoever, right? To whoever, right? To a teenage girl in Florida, to a 4-year-old in San Diego, right? It belongs to all of us, and that's very beautiful, and it makes a map and it makes a nation, but it's an idea, right? And it's an abstraction. And Ammon has a different one. And, you know, historically, public land is actually pretty new, right? So just the idea of it can generate a lot of different notions of we the people and different notions of value and different ways we prioritize the earth are expressed in that. But historically, it comes in, you know.
And it also comes into conflict with one of those things that is considered so sacrosanct. I even heard Boris Johnson, the presumptive prime minister of Britain today, suggesting that that balance between what it is that we allow the individual to do and to be in a free society versus those things that we have to share in common really to make it all work is really the difficult balance that we're always attempting. And he felt that the Conservative Party in Britain has done that successfully, or more successfully than any other party, I think, in any democratized country over the last 200 years. So that's the debate in part that's still going on, property rights, individual liberty versus a shared responsibility to a land, and who governs that? Is it the government, or is it the state government? Is it the federal government? And how does all of that work when you have a dispute about it?
I think there's probably a lot of people in Great Britain who would dispute Mr. Johnson's claims. In the United States, it gets very complicated because of all the localities you just mentioned. And then also it gets terribly complicated because the history involved in the different ideas that attach themselves to prioritizing those different structures. You know, I think that one thing that became very clear to me in this story is, besides the problem of the idea and the existence of America being a very tenuous thing, and I think we can see the tenuousness of how tenuous it feels to people in some of the ideology surrounding Trump, which is a very different right-wing ideology from that surrounding Ammon's, though there's definitely crossover. There's some very strong...
There's some crossover, but Mr. Bundy...
There's also some...
Cliven has some problems with Trump and the anti-immigrant policy.
Cliven and Ammon even more. Ammon broke more strenuously. He basically compared the people in his movement who are gung-ho about anti-immigrant rhetoric and the administration rhetoric to warmongering and to Nazi Germany, and it caused a big split in the movement. And it's precisely, you know, you can see it's the rhetoric around the border, right, and making the border strong and the wall that Ammon was objecting to. His ideology is a much more libertarian, very limited government kind of fantasy return to the frontier. Whereas, you know, with Trump, you have something else. We have to put a big wall, a big construction project, and close the frontier forever, right? It's a very different idea. And, you know, it obviously, if the nation felt like a secure idea, you wouldn't have, you know, that many millions of people invested in the idea of making the line, you know, the imaginary line where the United States begins more literally concrete, right?
That's a good way to put it.
That's what I think. I mean, I think a lot of people's investment in the wall is not necessarily, I mean, I'm sure they actually want the wall, but a lot of it is to say the word, to build the wall, and to imagine, you know, the reality of the country enforced in this way. And that tells us something about the tenuousness of that reality.
Absolutely. Anthony McCann is with us. It's a fascinating book. It really is Shadowlands, Fear and Freedom at the Oregon Standoff. Do you think that some of the standard causes that we hear for this surge of populism in our politics, economic disparity and the like, apply to this story?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that's absolutely true. It wouldn't have happened without those things. There's a lot of historical causes at root here, and just thinking about like your previous question, there's a lot of historical reasons why the conversations about state, local, and federal power are very difficult for Americans to have. I think largely because we haven't, a lot of people who are arguing for states' rights stuff from the right aren't willing to face up to the horrible legacies of that ideology in terms of its connections to Jim Crow and slavery. And those things were all involved in this story. But there are definite concrete economic issues as well. The West, a lot of the Intermountain West, has been suffering for a long time. It's always been a boom and bust, very extractive economy. And a lot of towns that were dependent upon certain single, you know, types of work, you know, have lost that. The public sectors and have suffered culturally. Those towns have suffered. You have extreme isolation and alienation in these places, a lot of declined opportunity. And it has the highest suicide rates. The Intermountain West has the highest suicide rates, especially among middle-aged white men who formed the core of the people following Ammon Bundy in the West, in the nation. And I think in a lot of ways, Ammon brought this, right, of divine purpose, God-ordained purpose. He brought together this sort of Latter-day Saint type language for non-Latter-day Saints. He wasn't trying to convert people to Mormonism, but he created this kind of new political theology, or he resurrected this hodgepodge political theology for the internet, that combined the language of prophecy and the high-minded talk of the Constitution, references to the American Revolution. And also, I think this is really important too, because a lot of the people involved in his movement aren't necessarily, like, they're not ranchers. There's very few actual ranchers involved directly in, say, the occupation. But that language of ranching and it's very complicated legally, public land and private rights and water rights and beneficial use becomes also part of almost the theolegalistic jargon that Ammon uses and creates this world of meaning for people who plainly, openly were suffering from it. A lot of people who were involved told me things like, this is the first time I experienced community in my life.
You know, you draw attention, and you did just a moment ago throughout the book, to that legacy of slavery and the Reconstruction era, incomplete, never really resolved. Why is this history so important to this story about public land in the West, when we often think it's more of a story about the South?
A lot of what's going on in this story, right, is about unresolved history from the same time period, from the end and the failure of Reconstruction and the beginning of Jim Crow in the South. There was a real, when that was abandoned after the election of 1876, a hugely controversial election that rivals, you know, our most recent one, the election of Rutherford B. Hayes, where a compromise was made basically to end Reconstruction and pull federal troops out of the South. That military power was deployed basically towards Oregon, other parts of the West, to try to reunify at least the white parts of the nation in the project of Western settlement, which of course meant huge trouble for the native populations, including the native population of Harney County, Oregon, who was displaced from its lands that were at the center of this conflict right after that election. And oddly enough, the general who was in charge of displacing them, somewhat reluctantly, was General O.O. Howard, who had been, under Reconstruction, the head of the Freedmen's Bureau, who had been involved in trying to create the conditions for a new free society for formerly enslaved persons. So suddenly he found himself instead displacing the Paiute of Harney County, who refused that displacement and you know, have been returned to the county and were there to remind Ammon Bundy when he said he was going to return the land to the rightful owners, who the rightful owners might actually be.
In Shadowlands, there's a lot of attention that you draw to the role of social media. Do you see the occupation as something that could have happened without the onset of social media?
Oh, absolutely not. There's no way. The way that they were able, just on multiple levels, strategically, Ammon didn't have to plan, right? And if he had to plan, then, you know, there's a lot of informants in that world, they would have been stopped, right? But he was able to just put out a vague call to come to Harney County to go to a march in support of these ranchers that they were supporting there and to intimate that something bigger was going to happen. He said something to the effect of, come join me in Harney County tomorrow for the wonderful thing the Lord is about to accomplish. I mean, those people just came, and they came with guns. And in doing so, because Harney County is a huge county, it's the size of Massachusetts, but it has only about 7,000 people in it, which means that they also have only about 5 deputies for that whole area. You know, the public sector is pretty underfunded there, and it's a huge place with very little people. They were able, because of their internet community and because of their ability to basically organize like a flash mob, to challenge sovereignty of the county and of the federal government in that region. And I think that tells us a lot about how social media operates. And also, I think in the story, you can see the role of feeling in our politics. I mean, politics is always about mobilizing feeling. But in these new platforms that we have that are both our public space, but are also, we have to remember, wholly privately owned, right? Spaces where public life and social life is being monetized for private gain, and also automated, right? People are being brought together through technology, right? And as we found out in 2016, on a large scale, a lot of what brings together people more and, you know, gets them more aggregated and, you know, clumped there on the platforms is ugly feeling and paranoid feeling. And all of that happened in this weird way that also combined these older, much, much older ways of thinking, these theological ways of thinking, to create this fascinating picture that culminated with this group of people out there in this place where none of them were from, basically doing what I saw as a Wild West reenacting settlement for Facebook Live, right, in the Great Basin Desert. And I think it said a lot about the role of social media and what we're still just beginning to learn about what has happened with human being and social being on the platforms.
Now, when we go to the latter part of your book, you're following the occupiers to their trial in Portland, and they also come into contact with other groups like Black Lives Matter protesters. Put this stew all together for us as to what it says about where our politics are today and how incendiary one small match might be in lighting all of this off.
What was it? There was something, I was very interested in the contact between some of the Bundyites, right? And again, they're a very heterogeneous movement, so like no single person speaks for the rest of them, and not all of them would have followed these lines at all. But Jason Patrick, one of the main occupiers, comes to the Bundy movement through being a very committed anti-police militarization activist from the right wing, from the libertarian side. A lot of these people around Ammon are, you know, were politicized by the Ron Paul campaign and also by the economic crash of 2007-2008. And so for a long time, Jason Patrick, you know, he came to this Bundy movement because of police stuff, related stuff. I mean, a lot of people came to support the Bundys in the first place because of a video of Ammon being tased by BLM officers, by Bureau of Land Management officers near his family ranch in 2014. So during the trials, Jason was trying to reach out to the local Black Lives Matter group, Don't Shoot Portland, led by a woman named Teresa Rafford, who's now running for mayor of Portland, to try to see if they could work together, because he supported her and her ideas about policing. And they had conversations, but Teresa was, you know, said thanks but no thanks, you know. And Jason just told me that he understood why maybe she wouldn't want to ally with him, but he continued to support her. She said something very interesting about Jason that's, I think, an important little quote in the book, that she really appreciates his support for her principles, but that there was a problem with Jason, and that's that he is, I think the quote which she said is, his views are who he thinks he is, which I think says a lot about the difficulty of alliances and conversations in our country. I mean, what Therese is talking about there is it's not just like I have these ideas about the Constitution, but he's coming from this movement, for example, that has this strong support for states' rights rhetoric, which has this total connection to the kind of history that Therese is fighting against. So I think that, that says a lot about the difficulty and hard work it's going to take for people who actually share convictions about prisons and policing, like Jason and Therese, to be able to work together. Though maybe it also shows that those conversations could begin and be possible. At the same time, since that time, that almost seems like a more hopeful time when Jason and Therese were not able to find a common ground to speak on than what's happened in those same parks where all these things are happening in Portland since the election of Donald Trump. That's where it's in those same few block areas that we're getting every summer now. These basically would have come to seem like scheduled melees between these very other groups that were not involved in this thing at all. Sort of from the more, I would see them as more, proto-fascist brown shirt type groups like Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys fighting with the anarchist affiliated Antifa people. And basically every summer there's riots basically now, or just brawls in those same parks. So even further from a conversation between anybody and more frightful.
Now, you do suggest toward the end of the book that you think a central question of the occupation relates to how government solutions perhaps can do something other than just privatize everything. And what is it that this high desert partnership might bring about? So are you less convinced today than just recently when you wrote the book that we can reach some kind of partnership or some kind of approach where the public and the private can both get what they want from these lands? Or are we asking too much of our public lands or the great Wild West as we have known it in America? Does it just hold up too many different prospects for too many different people?
I mean, I think that remains an open the High Desert Partnership that I just admire tremendously. I think they've had a lot of success in a very specific location. And
why don't you explain what that is?
So the High Desert Partnership is a group of formed, the collaborative group with that's open membership, but the group in it is basically local stakeholders and environmentalist stakeholders and federal government agencies. So, for example, in one of their groups, which is more concerned with the area around the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, you have ranchers who've worked with the refuge. You have people from the refuge. People from the tribe have been involved on and off. And then you have people from environmental groups who have a strong stake in the refuge, like the Audubon Society and so on. The Wetlands Conservancy, you have local government coming together to basically work together to come up with projects they're going to do together, and they agree on it by consensus. So you have all these people who in the past have sued the hell out of each other, basically have gotten tired of suing each other, nothing's been able to get done, came together to basically figure out if there was anything they could do together, and have discovered that in some cases there really is, and they've discovered a common bond for the land, and also they've discovered that there are just things none of them knew about the land, and that maybe they should dedicate their energy to inquiring of the land itself, what is going on and what might be best to deal with the different crises they're facing, because there's a lot of environmental issues going on up there, and there's going to be more with global warming and issues of drought. And that's been very successful. It's happening up in the forest as well. Malheur National Forest is facing a lot of challenges, a lot of possibility of catastrophic fire up there. So there's something that seems really possible there, and there's a spirit of optimism around that organization that's really, I find it admirable. And I've spoken at length with and corresponded with the director of the organization, a woman named Brenda Smith, about what struck me is like, wow, this really works in this polarized time. But does it really only work in this specific place with this deep attachment to this landscape, which is also, I think, really importantly, outside of those people? At a certain point, you can't say that the land is what it's not, right? Like it has its own authority. And I think maybe she's interested in how can we expand this model for working with communities, right, where you have conflicts. I think that's a really interesting challenge, because then if the actual object that you're trying to work on is the community as opposed to the land, right? Everybody's involved in that, and it becomes much harder to, I wouldn't say that anybody's claiming to achieve like total objectivity in the High Desert Partnership, but it certainly becomes harder when you're talking about a human institution rather than land. But the challenge is very interesting, and they've certainly been able to do some of it there. How translatable that is to other issues, larger issues, I don't know.
You know, well, you do ask us at the end of the book to really ask ourselves some pretty hard questions. Do we want private prisons? Do we want to privatize police forces, ambulance service, education? We know that's been on the table. So are those the questions that you want us leaving this incredible story with about where we're headed? Or what is it that you want us to be thinking as we close the last page of your book?
Well, I think that the things that that I would love to think about with readers of the book who are interested in the book are those things, right? Is it possible to develop a new kind of collaborative form of government where people are more involved on the local level with the use of federal power? I mean, that's one of the things that's really interesting about the High Desert Partnership, basically local people and then also environmental groups and stakeholders from the state, right, and local government are involved basically in coming together to make a plan for the federal government on how they act in that place. And that seems really interesting. That seems like one kind of path, right? But the other kind of path is where, you know, the sovereignty of the people is completely lost, I think. And, you know, the federal government, you know, contracts out work to profiteering private prisons. So I definitely want people to be thinking about which way we want to go. And I think it's pretty clear from my language which way I'm interested in going. But also I'm interested in thinking about the presence of history in all of our lives and in our political impasses right now. I think that's something we really need to do personally. And I would love to think about it more together with anybody who is interested in doing so, you know, and thinking about it specifically in relationship to the treasure of our public lands. And then probably the third thing, there's many things I'm interested in thinking about, but also thinking about that stuff, all that undead history that is so active in our life, how it swirls about on the platforms of the internet, and what is going on with the relationship between the power of the social media platforms and our understanding of nations. One thing I've been thinking about in relation to this story a lot lately is the recent story that Facebook and other companies are starting their own currency, basically their own bank that will totally bypass, you know, federal sovereign, you know, national sovereign controls of the United States or other nations. And in many ways, that makes for me, I look on a very tiny scale, the way Ammon was able to challenge sovereignty on this local level, this minuscule scale compared to that. In Harney County, I wonder if this story has something to teach us about what new forms of global governments, but what new forms of corporate power and ways that the platforms kind of are coming down the line.
In closing, how is all of this, you getting into nonfiction, affecting your writing, your poetry?
I haven't had time to write very much of it. It's something that I started to miss. So I'm trying to get back into that, just taking notes, being out in the desert, and getting back closer to the kinds of acts of attention that poetry allows. Though, you know, that because this book allowed me to move back and forth kind of fluidly between genres, there was a lot of pleasure in the writing and in especially moving through landscapes and also thinking about these big theological ideas that has a relationship to poetry. But I'm looking forward to writing something a little quieter, you know.
I'm interested in reading it. Anthony McCann, fascinating book, Shadowlands, Fear and Freedom at the Oregon Standoff. And I think, folks, it might be a good thing to read before the 2020 election, because those issues may have surfaced then in 2016 and have been ongoing as kind of a unbroken continuum in our history, but they certainly resonate today. Thank you so much for being with us on America Trends.
Thank you so much for the attention to the book and the time. I really appreciate it.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com.